And that's been the theme song for this program, On the Green Front, which has been on the Progressive Radio Network for, coming up on a year. I think I'll have to check that. I firmly believe we can turn it around, or at least I did until a couple of weeks ago when I had the, I won't say pleasure because it was quite disturbing, but I am one of those who believe that better to be informed, better to know what we're dealing with. Only then can we begin to face the problems and try to come up with solutions together. So it was, I would say, unsettling to hear a couple of presentations through the Environmental Forum of Marin, a local seminar series I'm taking here in Marin County for 8 Saturdays in a row. It's well worth giving up Saturday mornings to learn as much as I'm learning. And, again, I've been interviewing environmental experts for more than a dozen years. So if I've learned a lot and had my eyes pushed wide open, I have to say that I think this is something everyone should hear, and that's why I've asked Andre Angelantoni to join us. He is the head of the Post Peak Living Institute, and last week we spoke to the director of the Post Carbon Institute, and today we're going to be checking in with someone who has a similar perspective on coming eco-shock. A bit unsettling, as I said, but important, critically important, that we understand at least how some people are viewing what's coming up pretty quickly here in our future, all of our future. And then we're going to take a turn. I think this will probably work out nicely because the second half we're going to be talking about happiness, but not happiness in the superficial sense, happiness in terms of what is most fulfilling, how are we satisfying ourselves and making our lives meaningful. We'll be speaking to an old friend of mine, John DeGraff. He has done a lot of things, from the great film and book Affluenza years ago. Find out how many years it's been, maybe a decade or so, that I think I've been talking to John about that great work, about our overconsumption problems and how that doesn't necessarily lead to happier Americans being super world-class consumers. And they've also started a great organization called Take Back Your Time. It's all about doing a little bit more like taking a note or two from Europeans and other nations where they take, you know, longer siestas, longer vacations, don't work as hard, maybe not as, but perhaps not necessarily less productive than we are. And there's a happiness quiz that I just took in the last hour, so John and I will be discussing that after Andre and I get ourselves totally depressed. So it'll be maybe something Andre will want to stay tuned for as well. So without further delay, I want to welcome Andre Angelantoni to the Green Front. Welcome,
thanks,
Andre. Did
you,
I pronounce your last name correctly?
Angelantoni.
Angelantoni. Okay.
Yep, pretty close.
I'm having difficulty with it. If you just spell it out syllable by syllable, it's exactly what it says. But maybe I'm just freaked out by your message. Maybe that's it.
Yeah, I get that
saying
a lot.
Yeah, and it's funny because Nancy Bell, who runs the environmental seminar series that I just referred to, had said that this particular round of speakers will not be sugarcoating the environmental challenges we face, and that appealed to me. I said, good, because I really like to just hear it, you know, told as it is, and as experts view it from all across the green spectrum. And I must say, even I was not prepared for, you know, quite the dire message that you gave us. And yet you seem very calm, very rational. I did ask you if you have children. You said no, because I think that's where a lot of the dissonance comes from. It's one thing if we've done this to ourselves for the most part unknowingly, but certainly for the last couple of decades we cannot, as Americans, claim ignorance as to what we're doing in terms of not only incurring more debt in the financial sense but also ecological sense. But we, you know, have children. Many of us have hopes for their children and beyond. And I'm sure you have nieces and nephews and, you know, places you love too. So we're going to talk about, you know, your message and then just how we deal with the impact of that message and how we can not just go into either panic mode or adaptive mode, which I think is an important part of your message, adapting to what you say is coming. But also, how do we keep our lives meaningful, especially those of us who are doing work to try to educate and continue to try to awaken the slumbering masses? So let's jump right in. Let's get the bad news out of the way. What's the message here? What should we be aware of that perhaps even those who are thinking we're tuned into our environmental signals are not quite facing?
It seems to me that we've just been living for so long with the idea that renewable, I'm going to talk a lot about the energy system and how it relates to the financial system, and it seems that we've been living so long for decades thinking that renewable energy was going to allow us to continue this form of economy once the fossil fuels ran out. Well, the fossil fuels are not about to run out, but they are. One critical fossil fuel, oil, is about to start to decline. The International Energy Agency announced just abruptly in December of last year that the peak of conventional oil production was actually 2006. So we've been bumping along at this on this plateau of production, and within something like 2 to 5 years, according to the geologists, the petroleum geologists at the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, we bump along for another 2 to 5 years before it starts to decline. The problem with oil declining at this point is that we have less than 1% of our primary energy supply coming from renewable energy. So we're just not ready for it. And
it is startling how even though we hear so much about solar and wind and geothermal, it is such a small percentage. And yet, for those of us who thought that, you know, just amping that up across the board, you know, like on steroids, much more massively and quickly than we have been, would really make a dent. And are you saying not even?
Well, I'm saying we should do everything we can to get as many renewable sources online as we can, because once oil starts to decline, we experience another global financial crisis, just like what happened in September 2008, and then the credit dries up. We no longer have the capital to start to keep rolling out the renewable energy. This is my thesis, and a lot of people are coming to this point of view. The economists had told us that actually when high oil prices would come, that would accelerate the move to renewable energy sources. But that actually, when you've got the situation that we have now with so much debt around the planet, we've reached the point of debt saturation. So we're not actually going to accelerate the move. What's going to happen actually is the system is going to crack.
And what you and Ken White said is basically, you know, we operate as if, yes, that we can come back, you know, that once this the jobs come back and the economy strengthens, it'll look like it did, you know, if not quite, you know, during after the last depression and the First World War, but two, but that we have just an entirely, this is what you're saying, entirely different set of circumstances. So that old feeling of, you know, we can do it, and American ingenuity and innovation and can-do spirit is going to fail us this time because of the, in large part, because of the financial debt, the ecological debt, growth of population and consumption, growing energy needs. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. This time around, we have just too many things going against us all at the same time. The declining oil, climate change is getting worse than we thought even just 5 years ago, of course. And when you there's a direct correlation between how much oil an economy uses and how big it is. So as oil declines, the economy must contract. And a contracting economy, one of the ramifications of that is pretty much right away you get this large pool of unemployed people that just keeps on growing. So a lot of people are anticipating that we're going to resume growth. But if oil is over $100 a barrel and it's going to keep on going up, according to the IEA, they just announced that this week, then in fact growth is probably over for our species or for our world economy. Population growth will continue for a few more years, but economic growth has reached the peak, and it will, in fact, start to decline.
And as we start to see this happen, will we see panic ensuing as people realize that we cannot, you know, climb and wish our, and work our way out of it this time if your forecasts are accurate?
Yeah, if the forecasts are accurate, which, by the way, I'm not the only person who's been saying this. We've known this day was going to come for decades. Probably a lot of people will panic. What we saw in 2007 and 2008 is roughly 20 countries around the world experienced both food and fuel riots. And they're really related to each other. You have a food riot because often energy gets so expensive, you're spending money on energy, you can't spend it on food. Food price goes up because the price of oil goes up, and so on. So everything is really quite interrelated. So we're going to have that happen again. Could be as soon as 2013. It looks on deck for that. The projections that I have show that the new oil that's coming online is not enough to meet the demand of China and India. And, of course, we're still doing silly things like turning corn into ethanol, which means we take away something like a quarter of the corn production, which could be used for food. So when you're running full out in all of your systems, you don't have any buffer and you don't have any resilience. And people are going to start falling out of the economy. That's already begun. There are approximately 5 people looking for every job opening. And that will increase to 9, to 10, to 20. And then eventually new students will see that there's no value in getting higher education because there are no jobs for them. The people who are still working aren't going to give them up. They're not going to retire unless they're absolutely forced to. And so all of a sudden, there's no reason for kids to go to college. It is actually kind of a grim future. But what Ken from the Post Carbon Institute and what I'm doing with my instructors at Post Peak Living is we're showing people that if you start getting ready now, for one thing you can do is get emotionally prepared. It's much better to look at this ahead of time when you've still got some of the world working around you so that you can process it, get through it, and then start really looking hard at how you're going to adapt to this new future. And that's what we do at Post Peak Living. We have courses that teach people everything from Chickens 101 to how to start a garden. To also, we have a psychologist who has a course on how to handle the emotional aspects of this.
Before we get into that too deeply, because that is certainly an interesting component of what your message is, that you are getting very practical about just saying, let's just switch to adaptation here. Not that we're giving up on trying to slow or stem the damage, I don't think, completely, but, you know, adaptation has to begin now, not later. We had Cher Miller, Executive Director of the Post Carbon Institute, on last week, and so this is a continuing series, again, based on what I'm learning in the Environmental Forum of Marin series. And, of course, Richard Heinberg, great author and lecturer on oil and peak oil and energy issues, is quickly trying to finish up a book, I understand, called The End of Growth. That's a pretty provocative title, especially for those who have not been paying attention. What should we expect from that book?
Well, I know Richard well, and I know what he's trying to do. He's going to be making the case in his book that the growth that we've experienced basically for the last 10,000 years that was really put on steroids when we discovered fossil fuels roughly 150, 200 years ago and started using them in a really big way. And then if there were a superset of steroids, then that one would be oil. Oil really shot the world economy out of a rocket. And so you take away this steroid, and you've got an entire civilization that depends on oil. For instance, 90% of the world's transportation energy comes from oil. And then you make it really, really expensive, which is what's going to happen. And all of a sudden, all the money that you would have used for all the other things instead goes towards energy. And then the economy has to contract, and businesses lay off people, and governments have trouble paying back their debt. And that's actually the other side of the equation. It's really quite easy to convince yourself, if you just look at the energy system and you focus on all the great new technology, and there is going to be some great new technology that's going to continue to come to the market, like electric vehicles, for instance. I'm not a Luddite at all. I've actually put in my order for a plug-in Prius. I'm
so you do have hope. You do have hope, Andre.
Well, I would just be clear.
That's going too far.
that's going too far. It's preparation. It's not hope that
I'm
we can
to laugh.
Keep
I
this.
Just, I still have to just, you know, I hear your comments in the context of just walking around every day. And just this week I got into started out as a discussion, devolved into an argument, actually, and walked away from each other in sheer frustration. A friend I've known for 25 years who does not believe climate change is real, does not believe that we have anything larger to worry about than terrorism right now. And I sent him some choice videos that show, in addition to a couple that we showed in class, there's one that's 300 years of fossil fuel history in 300 seconds, and it just shows, you know, what's going on with peak oil and all the bullets we have to dodge. And that one didn't even include the financial debt scenario that you talked about. So, you know, here I'm talking to an expert who said, no, don't put words in my mouth. I don't have hope, Betsy. And yet most people are walking around completely clueless as to what we're even talking about in terms of the imminence of it and the impact and the urgency and the magnitude.
Yeah, there's always a lag in the system. There's always a point. There are always a few people who know what's going on a little bit ahead of anyone else. And
it's a blessing and a curse, ain't it?
Exactly. And mostly the rest of the people don't want to hear the message. So the same thing happened exactly with the housing crisis. There were some economists who very specifically said that we were in a real mess with housing. Peter Schiff, Nouriel Roubini, for instance, and, of course, Steve Keen. And they were roundly ridiculed by people. They said, look, we're in for a massive contraction in housing prices. And, of course, they were right. But no one else wanted to believe it because they wanted the party to keep on going. Well, it's the very same thing with our energy system. Everyone wants the party to keep on going. Everyone is expecting them to have a retirement. And I'm actually saying, no, retirement is actually going away. When we have the next global financial crisis, which is what we had on September of 2008, the central banks will probably step in again and inject large amounts of money into the system to keep it propped up again. And it may work one more time. But you got to ask yourself, how many more times can they make that work? Because we're basically at debt saturation. And eventually what happens is people look at this mess that we've created and they say, you know what, I've lost the confidence that I had that there's going to be growth or that there's going to be a future that I want to keep my money in the market. And then what happens is people start pulling their money out of the market, like what we saw in 2008, and then you get basically the beginning of a cascading stock market failure, which is what we had, which is what I'm expecting we will eventually have. You don't quite know what the trigger is going to be. Is it going to be the Suez Canal gets blocked? Is it going to just be multiple months of very high oil prices, and then everyone says, oh, these companies that I've got my stock, that I've bought stock in, are never going to produce the profits that justify their share price, so I should be selling. So the point is that the whole system is so wobbly, you don't really know what the exact trigger is going to be. So you have to get ready, though, because in my view, it's inevitable.
And just not to mention my friend's name, I hope he'll actually listen to this program. I'm going to send him a link afterwards. You know, he worked in the financial industry and retired, you know, successfully from one of the companies that was one of the ones that fell, you know, because of all the scandals and banking problems and debt. And so he's very much aware of, you know, what we've done in terms of leveraging our financial resources in this country. And yet, why is it so difficult for people with that viewpoint sometimes to see the ecological debt that we're accruing and to see the connection between, you know, ecology being the basis of our economy, and that without, you know, life support system that nature, you know, has bountifully provided and we have in some, to some degree squandered, that they're, you know, key, you know, there's synergy there, there's symbiosis, and we don't have much without the gifts that we get from nature every day.
Well, I agree, and the attempted answer that I would give you is that we're dealing with a group of people, the people who are alive today, who are at the very tail end of this astonishing period of amazing technological progress ever since basically the 18th century. Well, even earlier, but in terms of very widespread use of technology. And so the people that you and I talk to, they're very used to technology coming to the rescue. And it's a completely reasonable and valid response when they hear what I say to say, well why won't technology just do it, save us or make a difference?
I hear that all the time, including from school children who, you know,
exactly,
have been taught this, that we've got another planet. Mars will be habitable in just a few decades once we get some machinery up there,
exactly,
to climb it a little bit. No problem.
Exactly. So it's a completely valid and reasonable response. And it's actually, it takes a little bit of work and a little bit of time to walk through with them why technology in this case is not going to make the difference that they think. For one thing, people aren't including time. And when you start to look at time, you start to realize that we have less than 1% of our energy supply comes from renewables. Oil's about to decline. And it takes decades to transfer an entire energy system from one form to another. Basically, we had to be just finishing up now, installing the last windmills, taking the last internal combustion engine cars off the road and replacing them with electric ones, when in reality, we haven't even really begun.
So where does that leave us?
Well, it leaves us without adaptation. So I do have hope in one respect. I do talk straight to people that this future is coming. It's coming quickly. If someone's lost a job and is having trouble getting a new one, it's already hit them. The first thing I tell people is get out of debt, because I think we're going into deflation first, followed by hyperinflation, but we've got to work off a lot of the debt first. And if people want, you and I don't have a lot of time right now to go through all the details, so they can go to the website at postpeakliving.com, where I've posted the presentation that you saw.
Fabulous. It's riveting. And to anyone, including my friend who has, you know, three children, who is not concerned about, you know, climate change, peak oil, energy, you know, reduction in terms of resources, certainly the cheap, easy, attainable oil, you know, we're on the second half of that, and the backslope is a lot harder, more expensive, and going to be left, you know, prolific in terms of what they come up with. And we've just seen, you know, when things go wrong with the Gulf Coast disaster, well, apocalypse, as people are calling it, as we go ever deeper, ever farther to get the same oil to, you know, fuel our SUVs. And yet SUV sales are coming back, they say, so, and not necessarily the hybrid SUVs. So I'm so glad that you have that video available, because anyone who wants to discuss this intelligently or wants to, you know, think about a good future for their children should invest, how long is the video, to really take in what you're saying. And then, I don't know, what do you find when people see it? Do they still express skepticism? Do they stop calling you a Cassandra, an alarmist? Is it possible to dismiss it, given the way it was laid out in the presentation that I saw? It's too logical. You invite people to shoot holes in it, but it's kind of like everything we've been experiencing. And if this were the beginning of the end, not to sound too dire here, apocalyptic, but it seems like we could be on that runway. And I guess what was most disturbing to me was, I've always added at the end of that sentence, we could be on that runway if we don't turn it around now, if we don't start yesterday. But after what I saw you and Ken White, you know, present, I don't even know if it's something we can't turn around. I guess you're saying it's not. It's coming regardless, and we should just mostly get ready to adjust to it, adapt to it.
That's certainly what I think. I think that the forces that are in play right now are larger than you and me in any one country, and that they are going to play out, like I said, in what I think is we're first going to enter contraction. And so I think that people need to start preparing for something like the Great Depression. The difference is that this Great Depression is one that we basically don't ever get out of, because we'll be on the backslope of oil production specifically, but also shortly thereafter natural gas production and then coal. So it is a, in my view, it is a pivotal point for our civilization, where we are going to be living very differently. Our children and grandchildren are going to be living very differently. Our democracies are most likely going to be highly stressed by all these forces, because when unemployment reaches 30% and then 40% and then 50%, that tends to be when governments topple. And you can see that all over the place. So now, before we get too far down that path, I do want to point out that people are not helpless. There is, first of all, the Transition Initiative, which started in England, is growing around the world like wildfire. And it is communities that are getting together and looking at what their community is going to need as the economy contracts. So people are learning new skills, because as this economy goes away, this very high energy economy has allowed a great deal of specialization. And a lot of the jobs that exist now are actually going to go away. So we're training our kids to learn how to use computers and become stockbrokers or whatever. And in fact, that's exactly the wrong thing. Because we're going to become, you want to start thinking, in my view, you want to start thinking about how our great-grandparents lived. Because we're going to have to become, on the household level, much, much more resilient. We're going to have to learn how to grow our own food, how to make things, because we won't just be able to have, we won't have the money just to go buy them anymore. When as people keep losing their jobs, money is going to become very precious. And maybe for some of your listeners right now, money is already very precious. And that's not going to get better, because in a contraction, there actually is less money floating around. That's how it works, and that's all explained in the video.
So you're saying perhaps my husband and I, he's a lawyer businessman, I'm a journalist turned radio activist, should be counseling our daughter not to consider going into either journalism or law, but perhaps farming.
Well,
if there is soil to till, I mean, is it that bleak?
Well, so, you know, you want to make, yeah, there are community gardens that you can start. And I don't know if it's all the way down to farming. There's kind of an initial reaction, wow, I have to get right down to the production of food. And that's valuable, because when the Soviet Russia went through their collapse, what actually helped people get through, and the same thing with Cuba when they had their peak oil kind of moment when the Soviet Russia collapsed and they lost 50% of their oil imports, what helped their civilization get through was that so many people had kitchen gardens. They were getting something like 40 to 50% of their calories right from their back door. So, yes, there is already an explosion in gardening in the U.S., and it needs to continue exploding because, quite frankly, just people are going to have much less money to purchase food in a store. They're going to have to be growing it themselves.
So as I was listening, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so now for your daughter, you really do have to sit down and look closely at what it will be like when there are 10 people looking for every journalist job opening. Is she going to want to go down that path, possibly incur a great deal of debt, especially the way how expensive this higher education is now, and then run the risk of actually not getting her job that she's trained for on the other side?
I think there's about 100 people applying for every journalism position, if there are any, still open right now.
Oh, journalism
that's a contracting field.
That's right.
That's a contracting field.
So
right.
These are hard decisions, and we're living at the point where we have to make them with our children.
Well, and another so-called profession, trying to turn it into a profession, passion of mine, you know, environmental education, trying to raise awareness about these very issues. I think you were not even very optimistic on, you know, growth potential for people like that were in that classroom who were trying to help raise consciousness about what's to come. You're almost saying it's too late for that?
Well, I do. I'm not giving up on the environment. I do consider myself an environmentalist, so I do believe that we should keep working on the downslope of oil production. I don't want to just say screw it. We're going to lose. Sorry.
It's internet radio. You can say that.
Okay. Good. I don't really want to get into a position where we say, well, it doesn't really matter about the environment because what's happening with human beings is far more important. I'm not saying that.
Well,
so
of course, they're intimately connected. I mean,
exactly.
Our environment is our supply of food, air, water, and if climate change and you know, extreme weather events and, you know, smaller crop yields and more contaminated water or less potable water, you know, become something that we, you know, wage wars over, like we're now doing over oil. Is there anything that can be done today to slow that move towards the cliff that you say is coming? I mean, it's all connected. So it's no longer about the environment. It's about our survival, how we protect our environment. I mean, yes, besides humans, there's a lot of other critters that are worth saving, but I guess it's just that divide between what still feels like business as usual if you walk around, you know, out here, even where we live in, you know, pretty progressive Northern California, and these scenarios, and how do we prepare for, you know, business as unusual before the you-know-what hits, you know, the shift hits the fan, as someone coined.
Well, I would very much like many, many people to get ready ahead of time, because I think it's all happening in this decade, which, by the way, you could see that in the Limits to Growth book that was released in 1972 by the MIT group with the Club of Rome, and they basically said that in this decade everything kind of hits the fan. So we knew, like I said, we knew that this was going to come. You and I are just part of this global system, and the machinery is moving forward. And we didn't change the direction of how things were going. So if people look up the Limits to Growth, there's a 30-year update, which is the third edition of the book. And in that, they'll see Scenario 1, and you'll see that we are following Scenario 1 practically to a T. So my goal, my commitment is that we get as many people prepared ahead of time so that as the economy falters, there are some people that have their heads screwed on straight, that have a safe home that's producing goods, they have some skills, they have some confidence that they can make it through this period, because a lot of people are going to get caught completely unaware. Maybe even most people, 95% of the people are going to get caught completely unaware. So for the people who are listening to this, I encourage them to, you know, you don't have to believe me. Go onto the site, watch the video, look up all the references, and start doing your own research, and then come to your own conclusion. And if they decide that I'm right and that the financial system will crack as oil declines, then they should really get in action right away.
And any hope of getting to our leaders, you know, our legislative body, because, well, they you know, bicker back and forth, and it's partisan politics, you know, alive and well more than ever, or is that hopeless? We should just all take care of our own local communities and families.
Well, I'm always open to talking to government leaders. I only get to the local level. And when I spoke at the Association for the Study of Peak Oil, World Oil Conference in Washington, D.C., we had actually a closed-door congressional briefing that was packed door-to-door. And so, you know, there are efforts to let the body politic understand that this energy freight train is heading toward us. that there's no way that we can avoid it. It's going to hit because we didn't start early enough. However, it is a completely toxic topic. No politician wants to talk about this.
We thought they would stay away from gas taxes at any cost. This is like, that makes that look like piece of cake.
Right.
Something we should have done a long time ago. Right.
Yeah, they don't want to talk about this because there's absolutely no benefit in it for them. Hopefully they'll be out of office before the next person, and then it's the next person's problem.
Well, very few people want to talk about it, hear about it, and that's the great challenge, isn't it? That if what you're saying makes all too much sense, and as sobering as it is, I'm sure you've experienced it, and I'm just recently experiencing it, try to engage people in this conversation, and it's tough.
Yeah, you won't get very far with that. The conversation is growing. Like, lots of people are starting to hear this and starting to understand it, but it's still very, very small. It's like renewable energy. It's very, very small. So even though it's growing, most people will look at you like, are you crazy? Of course we're going to get out of this recession. It might just take a decade, but we'll do it. But they don't actually know what's happening on the fundamentals with debt and the energy system. And again, I'm going to say this is a terrible way, but they're a little bit brainwashed by how great technology has been. So they actually think that technology, we can pull a rabbit out of a hat again, when they don't understand that technology requires energy to run, and it needs a functioning financial system, which includes access to credit. And we are about to head into a massive credit crunch.
As I was driving home from hearing you speak a couple weeks ago, I had the radio on. They were talking about signs of economic recovery and job recovery, and they said there's finally light at the end of the tunnel. And I had a different view of that. What's at the other end of that tunnel after hearing you speak? The tunnel is much longer than we think, and darker, and the other side will look very different.
Well, it's true, but see, what people don't understand is that we've created a financial system that is essentially like a Ponzi scheme. And Ponzi schemes, they work until they fail. And we don't have a lot of time to go into the details, but I do talk about this inside in the video. But they work until they fail. And why eventually they fail is what is now really most interesting. So we've got, for the United States, for instance, everyone is really interested about the public debt, which is approximately $13 trillion, and they should be interested in that. But what they forget is that there's also the private debt, which is something like about $36 trillion. So in combined, public and private debt is about $50 trillion. If oil is going to decline this decade, which is what I assert and what the International Energy Agency is now saying and other very credible sources are saying, then that debt will not get paid back. No way, no how. Now, you've got two choices. You can either enter this kind of contraction like we experienced in the Great Depression, or we could experience hyperinflation because the government says we have to print money, and by flooding the marketplace with money, then these debts become a smaller portion of the overall size of the pie, and then we can pay them back. Either way, I come down onto the contraction side, like it's going to be more depression first. We've got to go through about a decade of that before hyperinflation will kick in, and I don't have time to explain all that. But the point is that either way, we basically lose the middle class. The middle class gets wiped out whether we go through a Great Depression or we go through hyperinflation, and that's why people have to get prepared, because there's no way out at this point.
And speaking of Great Depression, I think the comment that I was most impacted by among your many riveting statements is rethink that next vacation. You wouldn't recommend going on it. And I'm about to thank you for your comments, Andre, and introduce John DeGraff after the break, who is all about taking more vacations. He thinks we're way too stressed out. So I don't know if you want to listen in, but it should be an interesting juxtaposition.
Because I think happiness, us finding a way to be happy even with all this happening, is A, not only possible, but B, it's going to be necessary, because we're not going to get happiness from the ways that we normally think, whether it's vacations or the next toy.
And it's bittersweet, because one of the other comments that was so poignant, you said, knowing what you know and living, you know, with this knowledge, the silver lining has been, you know, you're appreciating food more, the diversity of, you know, what nature provides, that sadly, and this is the bitter part, especially for those of us, again, with offspring who have, you know, only the highest in hopes for their future, that scarcity that we know is coming, it makes it a little sweeter. We appreciate it now. It's just like anything, you know, don't know what we got till it's gone. but pretty disturbing, especially, again, if you have children in this world who are, you know, looking forward to the same very bright future that we grew up with expecting. And you know, how sad is that? But we'll end on a positive note by saying let's savor what we have and let's do everything we can to try to keep what we have from going away any faster than it has to, and perhaps, you know, some unexpected positive, you know, trends like transition towns and like the kind of work that John DeGraff is doing will make for an enlightened, different, more spiritually focused society. It's hard to imagine America shifting that quickly, but hey, if the shift's supposed to hit the fan in some way in 2012, it's later than we think. So stay tuned, buckle your seatbelt. Thanks for joining us, Andre Angelantoni, and your website for anyone who would like to hear more. It is quite provocative. It's quite good food for thought in terms of something to be aware of. I don't know if it makes good cocktail party conversation, but it certainly could make a water cooler conversation.
Yes.
Postpeakliving.com, preparing post-peak life. Thanks so much, and look forward to having you on again as we go forward into this unknown future. But perhaps it won't be as dark as you say. Perhaps we'll be needing to make a shift in consciousness sooner than we think, and perhaps that's not all bad. So we'll try to find a positive note to end on here, Andre.
Well, thanks, Betsy, for having me, and I'd be glad to come back.
Terrific. When we come back, John DeGraff will be joining us to talk about how we can find happiness in an otherwise bleak futuristic forecast with our energy needs growing and our consumptive trends continuing and our resources shrinking. It's there if we just look at it. So we'll be back in just a moment to talk with John and hopefully cheer ourselves up.